Again, 3779, Murphy versus Astru. Good morning, Ms. Downs-Temple.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Anna Downs-Temple on behalf of the appellant Dorothy Murphy. This is a Social Security disability matter where the claimant, Ms. Murphy, mainly complained of physical problems, but the record also establishes a mental impairment, which is the primary focus of our appeal.
I just start you off? Because am I correct that the only time period that we're addressing here is after October 2005? Because in the prior proceeding, the agency found her disabled for that closed period.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And now she concedes she's not challenged. Okay. That she engaged in gainful employment through the latter part of 2005.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So is she conceding that the ALJ was correct to find her not disabled through October 2005?
Yes.
Okay, we're fine.
The administrative law judge's decision in this case was woefully inadequate. It's a very brief decision, and it contains very little analysis. Our first issue in this case is that the ALJ failed to properly analyze whether the plaintiff had any limitations in interacting with the public. Dr. Glenn, who is a Disability Determination Services reviewing psychologist, was asked by the administration to review the evidence and to offer his opinions as to Ms. Murphy's mental limitations. He reviewed the evidence in the file, which included the report from the only psychological doctor to examine Ms. Murphy, as well as Ms. Murphy's statements in the case, which he found highlighted her tendency to ramble, to blame others, and her sense of outrage at what has been done to her. This was also consistent, he found, with the report of the psychological consultative examiner, who described Ms. Murphy as irritable, preoccupied with her problems, pressured speech, tangential and circumstantial, and some paranoid ideas.
Now, the consulting psychiatrist said that she has a possible delusional disorder, and it doesn't appear that anyone made a definitive diagnosis. So wasn't it your burden to clear up that ambiguity? Because it's your burden, of course, to prove the disability, and her testimony conflicted with the opinions of some of the experts.
Well, the ALJ did find that Ms. Murphy had the medically determinable impairment of depression, and so under the Social Security ruling 96-8P, she would have a medically determinable impairment, and depression is a condition that can cause limitations in interacting with others. So based on his review of the record evidence, Dr. Glenn had opined that due to Ms. Murphy's irritable and demanding personality, she could not work well with the public.
And let's clear one thing up in the record right now on the question of whether she was working with the general public in her part-time job as a certified nurse assistant. Was she or wasn't she?
The record isn't clear on this point. I mean, the ALJ certainly assumed that due to the job she was, and that it's generally in the type of job description, but the ALJ failed to ask Ms. Murphy at the hearing specific questions about, you know, how many residents she worked with, what was the extent of their work. You know, we just don't know. It's possible she could have, you know, only worked with several patients, you know, through a long period of time, and, you know, maybe they had dementia, you know, or maybe, you know, they couldn't talk, maybe they were severely disabled. We just don't know. And if the ALJ was going to rely on Ms. Murphy's part-time work to reject any limitations in interacting with the public, as found by the own state agency reviewing psychologist, it was the ALJ's duty to question her specifically on the specifics of her job.
But she did work 15 hours on Saturday and Sunday.
Yes, she worked 15 hours a week.
Which is a full day, I guess, each day.
Yes.
And then she did this for what period of time?
She did.
What were the time period dates that she worked in that?
I believe she had started that in the end of 2006, and she was still working at it by the time of the hearing, which was in August of 2008.
All the time in question here, we're dealing with, she was doing that part-time job.
That's correct. And she had also testified that she had been asking her employer for full-time work that whole period, and, you know, she speculated as to why the employer wasn't hiring her full-time, but she really didn't know. And so, you know, we don't think that work supports the ALJ's determination to find she was unlimited in her ability to work with the public when she, you know, had been working there for a period of time and still had not been hired full-time by them.
And of course, she hadn't been terminated either for insubordination, various and sundry other things.
No, she had not been terminated.
The ALJ, in his decision, he stated that he adopted Dr. Glenn's opinion, but he failed to even acknowledge Dr. Glenn's opinion that Ms. Murphy would be limited in working with the public. While he did say that there, you know, was a mention in the record of an inability to get along with others, he said there was no evidence to support that she could not get along with the public. However, in doing so, he still ignored Dr. Glenn's opinion that Ms. Murphy was limited in working with the public, as well as the results from Dr. Radomska's consultative psychological examination, which would support that she was limited in social functioning. If the ALJ's statement in that portion of his decision was meant to address Dr. Glenn's opinion, it would still be his own improper independent medical determination, because the doctor acknowledged in his assessment that Ms. Murphy was a certified nursing assistant, but still opined that she was limited in working with the public. So we feel that an award of benefits is warranted here, where the ALJ stated he adopted the assessment of Dr. Glenn, who in turn opined that Ms. Murphy was limited in working with the public, and the vocational expert in this case testified that an inability to work with the public in combination with Ms. Murphy's other limitations as found by the ALJ would preclude work. The ALJ further erred in claiming, again, to adopt Dr. Glenn's assessment, but ignoring other opinions that the doctor rendered. The doctor had opined that Ms. Murphy was moderately limited in social functioning and concentration, persistence, or pace. And the ALJ instead found that Ms. Murphy was only mildly limited in concentration, persistence, or pace and had no limitations in social functioning. The doctor had also found Ms. Murphy moderately limited in other work-related areas, and the ALJ failed to discuss those, and it included none of them in his residual functional capacity assessment. The Social Security ruling 96-6P requires ALJs to consider various limitations and opinions offered by state agency psychologists, such as Dr. Glenn, along with the doctor's actual residual functional capacity assessment. So we think that case should also be remanded for the ALJ to consider these additional opinions and their impact on Ms. Murphy's ability to work. Our second issue is that the ALJ failed to properly analyze Ms. Murphy's mental impairments. The Social Security Administration sent her to a psychological consultative examination in order to obtain more information about any possible mental impairment that she suffered from. Dr. Radomska examined her, and she noted in the examination that Ms. Murphy had poor concentration, had pressured speech, an angry and disturbed mood. She was tangential, circumstantial. She had poor paranoid ideas. The doctor diagnosed possible adjustment disorder as well as possible delusional disorder. And she assessed Ms. Murphy's global assessment of functioning score as being a 40 to 45, which denotes either serious symptoms or a serious limitation in occupational, social, or education. The ALJ rejected Dr. Damska's report because he stated that it was inconsistent with Ms. Murphy's testimony where she denied being depressed. However, Ms. Murphy never denied being depressed at the hearing. So it was erroneous for the ALJ to reject the doctor's report based on a misstatement of Ms. Murphy's testimony.
And but her own testimony that she got along with everybody and they liked her, that sort of thing. Is that meaning anything?
What she said at the hearing was that she got along with other people, but it was other people who didn't get along with her. So in our mind, that's fully consistent with, you know, the paranoid delusions noted both by the psychological doctor as well as the state agency reviewing psychologist, that it wasn't her that had problems, it was other people who had problems getting along with her. And it was consistent, too, you know, the state agency reviewing doctor noted her tendency to blame others for her problems rather than herself. So the ALJ was incorrect to just accept that statement at face value when the record showed that she suffered from paranoid delusions.
So the ALJ's failure to credit the findings of the only psychological doctor to examine Ms. Murphy without citing a conflicting opinion was error and warrants reversal.
It's similar to this court's case in Wilder v. Chater, where the court found that the ALJ was not supported to go in his decision to go against the only medical evidence in the case, which was a psychiatrist retained by the administration to advise on the claimant's condition. Our third issue is that the ALJ failed to make a proper credibility determination in this case. The ALJ relied on a boilerplate backwards credibility determination by stating that Ms. Murphy's statements were not credible to the extent that they differed from his own residual functional capacity assessment. The backwards reasoning in the ALJ's decision and at the hearing can particularly be seen in this case, because when he asked the vocational expert that included a hypothetical question that had a limitation in interacting with the public, the vocational expert testified that there would be no jobs due to the limitation in interacting with the public. And once the vocational expert testified that, the ALJ removed the limitation in working with the public, to which the vocational expert found jobs. This gave the appearance that the ALJ decided he did not want to find Ms. Murphy disabled and then worked backwards from there in assessing her residual functional capacity. The ALJ also failed to provide any reasons for finding Ms. Murphy not fully credible. He stated that he found her not fully credible for the reasons stated below, but he then just went on to discuss the opinion evidence and gave no reasons. The rest of his decision also doesn't contain any reasons. There are things relied on in the commissioner's brief, such as the ALJ's summary of the results of the physical consultative examination and Ms. Murphy's part-time work, but the ALJ never offered those as reasons for finding Ms. Murphy not credible. I see I'm into my time. If you are.
Good morning, Mr. Hill.
Good morning. May it please the court. Review of the facts cited by the ALJ and the reasons given by the ALJ show that the ALJ reasonably weighed all the relevant evidence in determining Murphy's work-related limitations. I would start out by clarifying that as far as the timeline goes, Ms. Murphy, part of the period of time that is under consideration, the period in early 2006, which was when she was seen by Dr. Rozomska, which she was not actually working at that time.
I have concerns, to be perfectly honest with you, about the credibility finding. To me, it seems circular. The ALJ decided her RFC by rejecting some of her claims as not credible, and then said her claims were not credible because they did not match the RFC. Can you explain that sort of reasoning?
Well, Your Honor, in standing alone, it doesn't make much sense. However, if you were to add in the other evidence that the ALJ cited, and then to explain that, these are the evidence that was not consistent with the allegations, then it makes sense. But in a typical format, it's not uncommon to set forth the conclusions and then give the explanation later.
No. Look. The ALJ finds that she had medically determinable impairments that could be expected to produce her reported symptoms. Then he finds that she wasn't credible about the severity of her symptoms to the extent that her report of symptoms was inconsistent with the RFC. That's just circular reasoning. The other problem with the credibility assessment is that she actually downplayed many of her mental health symptoms, and he seems to be quite content to find her credible when she says things that hurt her case, but find her not credible when she says things that helps her case. So when you say, working backwards, that's not a real good way for an ALJ or a judge or anyone else to deal, is it?
Well, Your Honor, I think the findings also deal with two separate issues. One of the issues is that, according to the statute, you can't have any limitations that they're not caused by medically determinable impairment that could cause the symptoms. The credibility finding itself is a separate issue of finding out how credible the allegations regarding the severity of those symptoms that could be caused by the medically determinable impairment are. But I think going back to this case, one of the things is that when it comes to what plaintiff actually testified to, the ALJ seems to have given credit to not just her testimony but that hurt her case, but even testimony that helped her case. For instance, she backtracked from saying she could lift 50 pounds to saying she could lift only 20 pounds, and it was the 20-pound limitation that the ALJ accepted. If even saying that even if the ALJ's credibility analysis is flawed, ultimately, what purpose would it serve to, or how did the ALJ err in rejecting? I can't find the limitations that she alleged that the ALJ rejected. The ALJ rejected the limitations alleged by the doctors.
You know, a GAF, that Global Assessment of Functioning score of 40 to 45, that demonstrates severe limitations. And consulting psychiatrists, you know, I've been doing this now for 28 years. Consulting psychiatrists do not hand those out routinely. We rarely see a number that low from the government's own consultant in a case where benefits are denied. Where does the ALJ account for the limitations demonstrated by that number? On what medical basis could he possibly have rejected that assessment?
Well, I think one thing, the thing about the GAF score is that the GAF score itself does not indicate any specific functional limitations.
Or Say it again.
A GAF score in and of itself does not indicate any particular limitation. A GAF?
Oh.
Sorry, Your Honor. A GAF score does not in and of itself set forth any specific functional limitations.
Oh, you were saying a GAF score.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. In and of itself does not set forth any specific limitations. Further, if going to the DSM manual, it explains that a GAF score only relates to a person's condition on that particular instance unless they say otherwise. But as far as a medical basis on why the ALJ would not have found Dr. Radomska's opinion that persuasive, if we go to the state agency physician, or state agency medical consultant who reviewed the record, that consultant looked at Dr. Domska's report and said, these diagnoses are not supported by the record. There is not enough here to justify any diagnosis, and the state agency consultant even indicated that Dr. Radomska seemed puzzled by Ms. Murphy's complaints.
Look, what if a consulting psychiatrist opines that a claimant has intermittent psychosis and the claimant gets on the stand and says, oh, no, I don't. Can an ALJ rely on the claimant's denial of psychosis to discredit the doctor when the condition itself makes her denial unreliable? And I'm wondering how this case would be any different. The consulting psychiatrist thought she had delusions and paranoia. She gets on the stand and she denies her mental health problems. What does a lawyer do with a mentally ill claimant whose mental illness causes her to torpedo her own case?
Well, Your Honor, I think what an attorney could do is to redirect the questions, which didn't happen in this case.
To do what?
To do more questioning of the claimant to try and get that testimony out. But
you'd keep asking her questions, would you?
If they weren't getting...
You see where it's going?
Well, Your Honor, you've got to get the evidence on the record somehow. And
well, yeah, but...
I would suggest that your hypothetical doesn't actually fit this case.
Okay.
In this case, Your Honor, the consultative examiner said that it was possible she had delusions. The state agency reviewing consultant said that
even if he said she had a possible delusional order, would the ALJ not have an obligation to develop the record to clear up that ambiguity? Where's the medical evidence in the record that contradicts this tentative diagnosis?
Your Honor, that would be the state agency consultant's analysis, who said that there was no history to support the diagnosis. And
yeah,
as you go back to the...
That's a psychologist. Radomska is a psychiatrist who actually evaluated the claimant in person. Glenn's report is based on a review of Radomska's report. And what sense does it make to, you'll forgive me, And only because I have to be this honest, my son is a second-year psychiatry resident, having given up the law after 17 years, but you don't need to hear my family problem. But what sense does it make to accept a psychologist's opinion when it's based on the rejected report of my son? No, of the psychiatrist.
Well, Your Honor, I would go back to what the psychiatrist himself qualified his own report as saying it was possible. He didn't come out and say it was definitive. And unfortunately, our statute requires that there be a medically determinable impairment that is established by clinical means.
Yeah, but I just asked you, why didn't the ALJ have the obligation to develop the record?
Well, the ALJ, I think, had enough here as far as how much is there to develop the record. The ALJ had enough information in front of him to determine that, hey, the state agency reviewing consultants indicated that there's not enough here for a diagnosis. Ms. Murphy testified that not only did she was not having any treatment and didn't report any problems in her testimony, but she also indicated that the psychiatrist misunderstood her when she was talking about hospitalization, that she herself had not been hospitalized. And to the effect that the psychiatrist is recording inaccurate information, that would affect, of course, the validity of the psychiatrist's examination. And to go another example is the psychiatrist thought she was talking to her landlord about $15,000, and at the hearing she indicated that the dispute was $1,500, which is a more reasonable amount. And it's not uncommon for people to have disputes with their landlords or their ex-husbands or their ex-employer.
She won the one with the landlord, as I recall.
Which begs the question, how delusional is she if her claims against these people actually had merit? And I think if you look at the whole record...
You don't have to be delusional in every area of your life.
True, Your Honor, but the question here, was it reasonable for the ALJ to look at the evidence before him? And I think also the strongest evidence here is that the employer who is hiring somebody to be a CNA to work with elderly people who are vulnerable people really would have
they certainly are vulnerable, but in many of those instances, in a nursing facility, they don't have a clue what's going on around them. And even your psychologist, Dr. Glenn, says that she would not work well with the public.
And that was Dr.
Does the ALJ give that adequate consideration?
I think the ALJ did give it adequate consideration because at the time that Dr. Glenn issued the decision, Ms. Murphy was not working. She was not working at that period of time. She was working later on, had been working for a period of years, and there were no reports of any problems with any of the people at the nursing home. And I would have to think that an employer would have a strong disincentive to keep somebody on staff who was having trouble with the nurses, with the residents, and with the other people on staff.
It kind of depends on how readily available staff is and how motivated that employer might be to document those kinds of problems that would show up in other reports where they're scrutinized.
That's true, Your Honor, but in this economy, it would not be surprising if they could find a replacement. But all that is really comes down to the question, was the ALJ reasonable in looking at the evidence before him and coming to the conclusion that he did? And I think that with the evidence that was before him, it was reasonable to reject a limitation on working with people based off of her own testimony, who which she had an opportunity to interact with her, and based off of the fact that her employers kept her on for all this time.
Wow.
You mentioned the ex-husband. I was clear about the dispute with the landlord and husband. Would the husband take the landlord's side or something or other?
Yes, Your Honor.
I don't know if you don't need to get too much detail. I was trying to figure out her family situation in that context.
And her family. It was unclear to me whether she was divorced or at what point she became divorced, but it seemed like she was separated from her husband and had a dispute with him.
Did she have three children at home at that point?
Yes, Your Honor.
One was 16. Were the others younger?
They seemed to, I think, all be teenager age group, if I recall correctly.
Well, she had her hands full there.
Yes, Your Honor, I would say so.
Gosh.
Your Honor,
you done?
I think we've managed to cover all my points, and if the court has no further questions, thank you.
Thank you so much.
You've got 3 minutes to rebuttal.
Okay, 3 minutes.
On the first point about Dr. Glenn rendering his opinion before Ms. Murphy went back to doing part-time work, the doctor did still consider in his opinion that she had been a certified nursing assistant, and she had done that for about 11 years prior. So there's no basis to assume that his opinion would have been any different. The ALJ also didn't state that he was rejecting Dr. Glenn's opinion about working with the public based on that, you know, he didn't know that Ms. Murphy had returned to part-time work. You know, but if the ALJ did think that, he could have asked the doctor, you know, if his opinion would still be the same, knowing that Ms. Murphy went back to part-time, or gotten an updated opinion from another psychological doctor or center for another psychological consultative examination. On the point about Dr. Radomska's report, while she did diagnose possible delusional disorder, she did note, you know, that Ms. Murphy had delusions at the record page 565 about her situation, and she stated they were mostly paranoid delusions. And if the commissioner, you know, relies on Dr. Glenn's opinion, he also opined that Ms. Murphy would be limited in working with the public. So on that issue alone would support reversal or remand in this case. And the point about that the psychiatrist had misunderstood that Ms. Murphy was not the one who was hospitalized in a psychiatric institute. The ALJ never relied on that as a reason for rejecting the doctor's report. But again, if, you know, the ALJ had relied on that, you know, she could have, you know, asked the doctor who, you know, was appointed by the administration if her report would be any different, knowing that it was not Ms. Murphy who had been hospitalized, or again, gotten sent her out for another examination. I think that's all I have.
Okay. Well, thank you, everyone. And the case will be taken under advisement. The third